This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Ashley Messenger. Ashley, it's great having you back on.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm also joined here again with Brandon Adamson.
Yeah, it seems like it's been an eternity since the last show.
Yes, yes. And Ashley, yeah. You write for Brandon's altleft.com.
Indeed I do, yeah.
Should
we just continue?
I guess this show I'll focus more on culture.
Cool.
One of the things we touched upon is there a large enough demographic for a dissident Swipple society? Or a maybe a red-pilled Swipple society?
Well, in Britain, I can only offer some limited commentary on that. Most Swipples that I know and interact with seem to have imbibed a lot of kind of classic neo-progressive narratives. And if you're wondering, I'm using the term neo-progressive to differentiate the standard sort of modern variety that we're familiar with.
SJW.
Yeah, yeah. To differentiate that from the early progressive movement, like the early 20th century, which was about eugenics and such like. So, yeah, there is some SJWism, but I wonder if maybe, especially with more and more immigration into our societies, that they will, at some point realize the incompatibility of their values, their socially liberal values, or, you know, whatever else, with radical Islam, for instance. I mean, there are places where people have sort of de facto Sharia courts set up, and, you know, the talk about no-go zones, that isn't quite as bad as it is in France, but it's like the typical British person, and this, you know, I'm speaking of the Swipple middle class to the extent that I've had experiences with them. The typical British person generally, I mean, the situation attitudinally with these people may actually be worse than it is in the US or in the rest of the Anglosphere or even in Europe, and I'm not exaggerating. Like, I've tried talking to them about incredibly innocuous things, really, in the circles that we move in, like the effects that changing demographics in an area, in a ward or a district or something, have on voting patterns, and they just have no idea, or they don't want to hear any of it. So yeah, that's basically what I've seen. What have you seen in this regard, Brennan?
Well, I think when you move out of these circles, it's almost incredible how the most innocuous or the most timid observations are treated like you know, as if they're like awful neo-Nazi or something. Even just the mildest kind of comment, but I don't think that there is a large demographic for these kinds of views. I'm not one of those people that is like interested in, and we got to win over the masses and things like that. I think it's number one. I think it's too late for that. And number two, I don't have the same fetish for like the masses or whatever. I mean, I worked in retail for years and years, and the masses like can't even read and interpret a coupon correctly. Like, you know, they're not like they're not going to understand any of this intrinsic stuff, and it's almost not even worth it. So I believe that you should focus on doing more with less, and that is like you're never going to be able to win a national election with these ideas. I know that these
well,
people.
Well, then the problem is if you're such a small group, that makes you very weak,
vulnerable,
and
yeah.
vulnerable.
And the other thing
well,
is,
but let me finish though. What you've got to do is, you need to become as powerful as you can with a small group, and not in terms of electoral policy. But I mean, look how powerful a company like SpaceX is, or you have these. Look how much power that Silicon Valley wields. It's just this small group. So I think you have to think in those terms of like where, you know, make as much, do as much as you can, and you know, these people instead of like, you know, you're not going to be able to win a national election with the margins that you would need to implement any of these policies. I mean, Trump won the election. He can't, with the courts and everything, and despite having the entire Congress and the Senate, he can't even get the mildest, like, immigration restrictions past the courts and through, you know, he should have been able to build the wall in 2 seconds, you know, with the kind of majorities that that he has. And so you would have to win an election with what, like 80 or 90% of the population in order to overcome all of these electoral obstacles. Like, it's not going to happen. Even if you're, you know, you have these people in the alt-right that are like, oh, you know, get involved in your local community and get that. Like, what is a local community? It's like you're going to go to a town hall meeting and there's like a bunch of Indians there, and you're going to convince those people that they need to close the borders. Well, not in your town, but I think that you need to start thinking in terms of like you know, groups of like a collective, in like buying an island or something, and just going somewhere where nobody else wants to go, and slowly building it up. You know, it's kind of like that that news with the Republic of Florida or whatever. Like those.
Yeah.
You know, have you ever been to Miami? Like, there's like just like millions of like Jamaicans and whatnot there. You're not going to be able to take this 1% of and like remove all those people. Like, you can't do it. But if you counted up all of the people that did have a lot of these, or that were sympathetic and intelligent, you would have enough people to start to do something. And I think it's like people are just really. They don't really understand that they're trying to do something which could have worked maybe 25 or 30 years ago, when you had enough majorities where you actually could have closed the border and said like, okay, well, anybody's here, they at this point, like, they'll be able to assimilate, but you know, we've got a 50-year moratorium on any immigration. But it doesn't exist as a nation. Even just the amount of people that support having a nation state with defined borders, like, even that is like it's almost impossible to achieve at this point.
You touched upon this, but with Swipple's, I mean, forget about the more controversial issues. There's a group called Progressives for Immigration Reform, who make the case for immigration restriction for ecological reasons, and even groups like that get totally marginalized.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, completely. You know, there's just no, but even taking it away from like just these progressive groups, and even in the right wing, there's not enough people. You're not going to be able to convince enough people to overcome the electoral obstacles that would be necessary. So you have to think, well, what can you do? You can either try to do what some of them, which I think won't work, is try to convince these other minorities to just embrace some kind of generic American identity. I think it's too late for that, personally, because I just think it's too late. And then there's also the and number two, they're not interested. So it's like,
yeah. Did that policy even work when the United States was 90% white? I mean, I think even back then, the blacks definitely black Americans regarded themselves as a separate thing, a separate community. Yeah.
Well, when I was like an 80s kid, and when I was a kid in the 80s, it really was starting to get to a point where blacks and whites were getting along. I actually liked the level of diversity that we had in the 80s. It was kind of enough for like flavor, you know, and these to make things interesting and
incredible range of restaurants. I'm just kidding.
Well, but people like largely were able to get along. Like,
in, yeah. I know.
And what happened was, I think that by bringing in all of these millions and millions of people from just everywhere in all of these like hostile cultures and whatnot, it really did a great. It really ruined something that kind of like was okay. It did a great disservice to it. Because not only did they bring in all of these other groups, like Arabs and all these kinds of people, but then they also encouraged those groups to not embrace an American identity, but to become like their own racial grievance group. So they brought them all in, like fomenting this stuff, and actually not even encouraging them to assimilate, but encouraging them to do the opposite. I think that just did a great disservice.
What you were saying about the kind of ideal diversity, I think SWPLs are not really colorblind because they don't want to live in a area that's like 90% non-European, even if it's like a 90% Asian area that's low crime. SWPLs have their kind of like idealized version of diversity that's maybe 60 to 70% white, then the remainder as being super diverse and lots of ethnic restaurants. So they have their vision of like an ideal society, and those types of places are, I mean, they're fairly desirable. So in a sense, they are race realists. They're just dishonest about their views.
Implicitly.
Yeah, well, I don't think I don't think some of them are conscious of it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's subconscious, but they do. Those are the kind of places that they're attracted to.
Yeah, I use this term in my most recent blog post, I think, implicitly white nationalism. And you definitely do see a lot of that in these little niche communities. I remember looking at I think I mentioned it, Effective Altruism. I was watching a talk by Diana Fleischman for Humanists UK. She's this professor who works in a university on the South Coast. And yeah, I was just listening to that talk she did, talking about effective altruism, and the audience is like all white and all visibly middle class as well. And Anatoly Karlin actually has numbers on this. He had a post on uns.com where he was talking about the demographics of these communities, like effective altruism and transhumanism, Occupy Wall Street.
Well, I would think transhumanism would have a significant number of Asians.
Yeah, according to him, I think it was like 80% white, between 80 and 90% white, and the remainder was Asian and Ashkenazim. Yeah.
And it's also the same demographic breakdown if you go to an environmental meeting.
Yeah.
Like historic preservation, environmentalism, all those SWPL causes.
Yeah, I would say so.
But yeah, I don't know. I think that kind of goes into what I was talking to you before about Robert over message, was that people like this alt-right and like Jack Donovan, you'll become a barbarian in this kind of thing. Cycle. You know, that's like, you know, he could be like this big barbarian dude, but you mean just like watch how pathetic that person looks when he's getting like tackled and tased by like a bunch of this. It just has absolutely nothing. Like, you're going to have much more power if you focus on technology and things and becoming so advanced that, like, you know, these other the worship of this like this whole barbarian thing, and it's like if you just like, you know, like watch a, like a black guy running from the cops and getting like tackled and pummeled, and that, like, that's really like, that's, you think you're going to emulate that and you're going to like take over or something? It's just kind of like, you know, you should do what these other people like Peter Thiel are doing, you know, like injecting like children's blood into themselves to become like immortal vampires or something. Like, that seems like a more you know, I'm not necessarily seriously advocating that, but you know what I mean, though. It's kind of like, it's a
different
sort
of
mentality.
You're not advocating injecting children's blood into you to become a vampire? I would fully endorse that. It's, yeah.
Well, maybe with the parents' consent, you know, I mean.
Of course.
I don't even know where you would go to do that, or it seems like that it, you know, the whole, I'll have to look more into that and see what the
found out about that from the TV series Silicon Valley, but I didn't know it was that widespread.
Yeah, I'd be interested in knowing more about it, but I think that there's like that kind of mentality, I think, is the more of a mentality that you need. It's kind of like, and I don't want to like LARP in terms of like video games and things like that, but if you've ever dealt with any kind of like video game or simulation or something, like what happens like if you just like you know, mass produce like footmen or something like that, you don't overtake something that is like a high level something that is achieved in the other simulation, you know what I mean? Like, they just wipe out everything, like the person's like a hero or whatever like that. And I think that even though those are just games, I think that's like there's really something to that, even in the military or something, like one like the U.S. Air Force or something versus some other a country that has the best tanks in the world or something. Well, still, they don't stand a chance, like.
Yeah, that's why I think all these, I mean, I used to buy into this thinking, but I think all these conservative libertarian types who say guns are necessary to defend liberty, they're totally delusional, because the whole technological apparatus of the police state is so powerful. But I also think in the future, I know Scott Jakich, who we interviewed, has that whole series, The Robot Lord, I think it's The Robot Lord Overlord or something like that, about how technology will become so powerful with robotics that will make a revolution practically impossible. So a lot of those gun nut types are delusional when they talk about, oh, I'm defending my liberty.
Well, yeah. Not just that, but also surveillance. You know, surveillance is so powerful now that, like,
well, I remember
you could send a message to some dude online, just even to try to make the smallest organizational move, and like, boom, you know, somebody's on you in a heartbeat, and you're toast. Like,
yeah, and I remember even Jack Donovan, to my surprise, actually pleasant surprise, pointed that out, that he knows all these gun nuts who libertarian sorts of the sort of standard stereotypical variety who are always fantasizing about, you know, the day when the government's going to come, and, you know, the reality, and this is something that he said, was that the reality is that the government has drones and Apache attack helicopters. Like, they're not going to have a fucking chance in hell.
Yeah, so. Exactly. I think the best way to take power is to analyze a lot of these successful mercantile minority groups and copy some of their strategies. The blogger Giovanni Donato has written a lot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, or even even joining the military and achieving a high ranking or something, and somehow leveraging that You know, is it something else? Because you see that a lot, is that a lot of the the military is just so, I hate to overuse this term, but just like so cucked and something like that. It's just kind of like you would almost be better off rather than explicitly trying to make this like ideological violent or physical revolution. You'd almost be better off just kind of becoming successful and leveraging that in a way so that you actually create the kind of society that you want to live in, because the way that you've created it is that these other people wouldn't have access to it. You know, either they would be priced out, or they would it would be a society that they wouldn't even want to live in. You know, like, you don't have to worry about these groups infiltrating transhumanism because they're just not interested. They're not remotely interested in it. Like, so.
Yeah. And I actually, as far as the demographically, that the minority within those groups tends to be East Asians, I actually wouldn't mind living in, I think I talked to Brandon about this. I guess I could be happy in either or. I could be happy in a 100% white society that was concerned with my kind of concerns, but I could also just as equally be happy in, say, like a white Singapore, a society that was, say, three quarters white, and, you know, normatively, right. Yeah, normatively.
Are you talking about what Pillater has been advocating?
I guess sort of like that, but basically just a normatively European society in the way that Singapore is normatively Chinese, but 75% white, and then the other 25% high IQ non-white groups like Asians. Yeah.
If you had like for me anyway, if you had the kind of society that you wanted, some kind of weird like transhumanist like Mall Island or something like that, and for whatever reason some blacks were actually interested in that sort of thing, like that'd be totally fine.
You know?
It's just a matter of like it wouldn't bother me a bit. Like if you have a few outliers that are just like into this esoteric stuff, I think that's like there's totally nothing. There's totally nothing wrong with it. You don't have to be like that retentive about it. That you're just going to like, you know.
I think that white advocacy should be, I guess, nested within, you could say, other projects of that sort, like transhumanism and futurism. Yeah.
Yeah, I basically agree with what you were saying, but you see that even within like a lot of these alt-right organizations like Amarin, like you maybe have a handful of Asians and people of a Jewish background, or even people of different backgrounds who are sympathetic, and I think that's perfectly fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were you saying about kind of like a white Singapore?
Yeah, I was just talking about how, as far as scaling down society goes, I'm sympathetic to a lot of pan-European sentiment in the sense that I don't think nation-states of the kind that have existed for the last, 300 or 400 years, since the Treaty of Westphalia. It's, you know, it's kind of an NRX talking point that it's a relatively new thing, but I don't want to do what they want to do. I basically want to have a society where these ethnic differences aren't maybe as important anymore, but there are these communities, city-states, or as big as they're able to be, basically, or as many people who are interested, whoever's interested, to form societies on that basis, whether it's transhumanism or alt-leftism or that kind of thing. And, you know, people talk about integration of non-whites into currently established European societies, nation states, is probably impossible, in significant numbers anyway. But maybe if you had if you were building new societies with a totally new, I guess, ethic, and you allowed people who were interested in these things to be part of it, like, as I was saying, white Singapore, with this kind of transhumanist idea, and as long as you made it clear the way it was going to be normatively from the outset, then I think it could work.
Yeah, if those people are minority groups, but they share the same basic values. The problem with our society is we have groups that are either hostile or they're being used as political pawns of the establishment. But if you have like a society based on your own values, whether it's transhumanism or left or the alt-left or whatever.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a firm believer that if you want to become autonomous or isolated, the best way to do it is to go somewhere and create something that the people that you don't want to, that they wouldn't be interested in. You know, that's like if you picture, you're going to have a state, and what's going to be on TV? You look at the channels that, like, you know, that certain groups of people just like would never be interested in watching, or like very rarely are interested. Kind of like this implicit stuff, you know, like in like dog shows and things like it, just kind of like this stuff that that people wouldn't be interested in. So it doesn't.
Yeah. I guess I'm interested in dogs as well, but I'm interested in doing weird things with them, like genetically modifying them.
Well, but that's what I mean. Like, you have certain channels that are kind of really like implicitly white or European, because it's not like they're not actively trying to exclude anyone. It's just like, you know, like a black person would see that and be like, oh, you know, that's some white people shit, like, you know, or something like that. That's kind of like that's all I'm really saying, is that if you you create something that's like that, and then
well,
for whatever reason, there are
I know Cartrell, who's been on the show, he's black and he's into all that stuff that we're interested in.
Adventure kid.
But the thing is, I mean, he's kind of, I mean, he's a great guy, but he's kind of an outliner.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but to the extent that, like, there are a few outliers that are interested in this sort of thing, like, I think that that's just totally, that's totally fine.
He brought my attention to that book by Peter Maruzzi, Fine Dining, about all the mid-century modern restaurants, so I'm gonna have to check that out.
Yeah. I will.
Yeah,
as well.
And even someone like that will, if they have the curiosity and imagination, and also like the kind of stomach to like to put up with some of the shit that people say and do, if they have that, then I think that's like, you know, they think they deserve a certain amount of respect, and like, yeah, who cares? I don't have like, I mean, one reason I, you know, one thing I don't like about a lot of the these alt-right circles is just
the people
these,
who
like,
are always like the people who are always screaming kike kike nigger nigger faggot. Yeah,
well, it's just like, or they get upset, they can't.
That's
like,
so
that,
tedious.
That you even,
yeah,
that you're even like can like talk to a black person or get along, or that you're even like, you know, that you would even like talk to a Jew or something like that. It's just kind of like, it's just kind of like, well, gee, like with that attitude, it's like, it's almost like, how do you even function in your everyday life? Like, can you imagine, like, I mean, don't you work at your job and you work with like black people occasionally that are like good at what they do and, you know, interesting to talk to? It's just kind of like,
yeah,
you know, I mean, I'm pro-white because like these other groups, are anti-white. They're openly hostile to me, you know?
Yeah.
So there's nothing preventing me from like, you know, like talking to, or even just being like, oh, you know, and I completely understand that the demographic issue is like, well, if you don't exclude them, then they're going to overwhelm you and all. I totally get that. But like, again, I don't know how these people function in everyday life. If you're just going to be a complete asshole to anyone, even if they might have something that they can contribute.
Ashley, I want to ask you, what is your interest in biopunk, and what is biopunk? I think we may have touched upon that on the last show briefly.
Well, I think you kind of wanted to talk about retrofuturism, and it was, I guess, kind of riffing off that. And
so Biopunk it's based on science, but it's also an aesthetic. So it's those renderings of those skyscrapers filled with vertical farms and stuff. Is that basically that is?
Oh, well, that's something else I'm interested in as well. There's a whole kind of genre of architecture called biomorphism, which basically means architecture that replicates, explicitly tries to replicate forms that are found in nature.
I think they have stuff like that in Singapore.
Yes, that's actually exactly what I was thinking of. Yeah, they do. And all of the... I love the kind of aesthetic of a city with huge green spaces woven within it as well. Like the greenery in the parks and the way there's like, you know, you can almost imagine there are places in Singapore where there are buildings that have trees on top of them and like parks almost, it looks like. And it just, you know, it would be really fun to walk your dog up there or something like that, as long as there's a fence around and you're not gonna, you know, risk your dog flying off into oblivion. But yeah, that's interesting. And I was in that article, that first article where I used the term, I was basically just using it as a shorthand for eugenics and transhumanism and the like.
So with retrofuturism or archaeofuturism, there's a whole bunch of subgenres. So Brandon, you're primarily interested in the mid-century space age aesthetic.
Well, I would say maybe even later than that. I kind of like more of the stranger, kind of like the late 70s, early 80s. Not even just the
like Logan's Run,
but just kind of, yeah, exactly, kind of like that. I think that had a little bit more than the mid 60s kind of. I do like that too. I just think that the I feel like the late 70s is a little bit more cerebral, you know, or something like that. I guess that's the way I could put it. It's just a little bit more out there. So that's kind of what I like about it more.
And Ashley, you were telling me you were interested in a steampunk, which is based on the Victorian era. I guess books like a Time Machine and how the Victorians envisioned the future. I guess another
example...
Right.
Or like Final Fantasy.
Oh, exactly. Fantasy, right? Or even if you've seen the film Blade Runner, there's that Bradley building in downtown LA, which is popular among the aesthetic. But also, I mean, you mentioned you visited London. London is filled with all these like old Victorian train stations, and you even see the influence in the undergrounds.
Yeah, and urban fantasy as well. It's very common in that particular genre of literature to have a steampunk aesthetic. It just really seems to lend itself to that. And yeah, the railway stations in Britain, you were saying when we were having a direct message conversation, and Victorian style in general, which steampunk seems to draw a lot from. And because like a lot of retrofuturism is based on taking the technology that defined an era and extrapolating it and sort of universalizing it in a surreal way. And with steampunk, that was obviously steam power, and that does to me sort of bring to mind an image of Victorian England, a somewhat romantic image, I guess, of Victorian England, that the scientists and engineers that defined that period, Isambard Kingdom, Brunel, and these guys. And it was at a time when Britain was really at the height of its power as a world power, that the empire, which, again, I'm not talking about going back to that, but I think implicitly a lot of British people do have a certain romanticism about that anyway. And much of the historical drama that I like, the period pieces that I'm interested in, come vaguely from that era of history, like, say, the last 30 years, maybe, of the 19th century, and the first half of the 20th century, and Art Deco, and all
this.
There's
also Deco Punk, which would be... There's the film Metropolis, and kind of Art Deco
Dark City
steroids.
As well, I think.
Oh, yeah, Dark City. Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Well, interpret a lot of as like retrofuturism is really like visions of the future that existed in the past that were like maybe weren't realized. And so that's what that's where I like a lot of the 1970s visions of the future, which were kind of often depicted as kind of dystopian, but in a way where you would be like, wow, I'd actually want to live there. Like,
well, what's interesting is those deco punk renderings. I've seen a lot of illustrations, and there were these illustrations back in the 1920s or 30s of how New York City would look like in the distant future, where they would have all these like roadways layered over one another and walkways layered over one another. And then you go into the 70s, and what Brandon was talking about, and that's kind of more spread out.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that Britain almost seems like made for steampunk. I mean, with just like with the steam engine and all of that, like they seem, it's almost like just tailor-made for there to be some kind of like steampunk futurism there just because of the history.
Yeah.
The thing is, people lack so much imagination and architecture. I mean, I'd like to see some of this stuff implemented in the major cities like LA, New York, and San Francisco and London. But even in Las Vegas, you don't even see this being implemented, or in the theme parks. A lot of the new stuff going up in Las Vegas lacks imagination.
Yeah, it's very
kind. Oh, yeah, and there may be that new, like, what is it, that new awful casino that's, like China-themed? It's like, oh, like, do we really need, like, more, like, Chinese stuff? Like, why wouldn't they, couldn't they come up with something more imaginative? Is it just, like, you know what I mean? They have that new, I think we walked by it the last time
we
were there,
did.
Robert, when we were, like,
it's still, like, under construction.
Yeah, but it's just like, oh, gee, really, that was your big idea? Like, that's not even, like, unique or interesting at all. Like, if I want, like, I could just go to Walmart or something if I wanted, like, you know, enjoy the Chinese aesthetic or something like that. Like, it's just kind of like, there's already enough of that everywhere. So, like, I don't know. That's kind of annoying. But I think you're right. And I think that that's why, though, that you, if these are your kind of dreams, you have to do it with a, you have to do it the hard way. You have to take over a small area or something and just start like getting money and making this stuff happen. I don't think that you really have to do it the hard way. Is like just infiltrate these kind of, and direct them. But the problem is that the financial incentive is just for them to build these like these really cheap El Cheapo like kind of like.
I don't know. I think
buildings
the Chinese
just kind of like,
thing. It's maybe generic in China, but I think it's kind of unique to the United States. I don't know. It looks futuristic from the renderings.
Yeah, a lot of.
Yeah, I mean, it might be, but it's just kind of like, I just feel like, well, it's just like things are becoming more Asian here anyway. Like, you know, the whole point of building something like that would be to make it like a really, you know, like why don't they have like a Mars themed casino resort or something? That would be fucking awesome. You know what, like why do they have to do like think in this kind of like this cheesy way? But also just the building of these really cheap buildings, like what's that casino, like Cosmopolitan, which it basically like reminds me of like a giant like Forever 21. Like really, like that's what this is supposed to be like.
Didn't we visit that place?
Yeah, I think so.
You know the Caesar's Palace, what's it called, the Emporium Shops, that was actually my inspiration for the Erotic Emporium.
For the Erotic Emporium.
Yeah,
I remember you talking about that.
that's great, actually. Did you see my, that someone reviewed my book, Beatnik Fascism? I sent that to you.
What
was
that site? Aryan Skynet. He's interesting because he's like a hardcore racialist, but he's open-minded culturally.
Well, that's why I've always gotten along with those guys, because they have similar interests as me, and I think that that's what a big turnoff about the alt-right is, when you get to know, you realize that like, oh gee, I have nothing in common with these guys at all. But like, but those guys, like we can, you know, they, you know, we can talk about like Something Weird video and just all of this like obscure film and music and things like that, and I think that that's really important. And one thing I always like about those guys is that when, you know, when I put out my book, I thought that, like, I was going to get support and, like, promotion from all of these different groups and sites and whatnot that I had, like, been on good terms with and interacted for years. Like, at the very least, you know, they would review it, and even if they gave it a bad review, like, at least, you know, I think out of all the people I interacted with, the only person that was promoted was, like, Millennial Woes actually promoted it on his channel, which, so I'm, like, I forever will, like, I view him as, like, a friend, because he's someone that you could genuinely, like, network with, which is, whereas all these other people that I was on good terms with, like, they completely just would, like, blew me off and ignore it. But I think when I emailed Hipster Racist or one of those dudes about it, they're like, yeah, like, you can promote it on our site, and then I'll repost it on three different of my sites. Like, that'll help you out. And I thought, like, gee, like, you know, it really got me to thinking differently about ideology, and, like, well, you know, maybe that's, these guys are actually better because, like, they're actually willing to network, and you can actually cooperate with them, and there's something about that really doesn't exist with these other groups, even if you agree with them on some level.
Yeah, with my book, the only major alt-right site to review it was Countercurrents, but that was largely because I have a history with them, and because James O'Meara is kind of he's a weirdo,
right?
And he's kind of a pariah, I would imagine, within the alt-right because of his views on various things.
Yes, of course. Ashley, what are your thoughts on the whole Fashwave aesthetic, which is based on the cyberpunk, vaporwave, 1980s retrofuturism?
The 80s retrofuturism stuff, yeah, that's and vaporwave and all that. That's something I'm peripherally aware of, not so much as the other kind of genres within say retrofuturism.
Well, Fashwave is popular on all the alt-right stuff, including the more crude sites like the Daily Stormer. But
yeah, it's...
what's interesting is, like, the old school neo-Nazi types were very rigid culturally, but now you have this thing called Fashwave, which is overtly futuristic.
Yeah, it's interesting that many of them are like 80s futurist aesthetics, considering that, whilst perhaps maybe not the fascist types, but the traditionalist Catholic NRX types. I think I remember Faith Goldie even uploaded a video with an intro that kind of had that kind of aesthetic feel to it, the fash wave you were talking about, and that this weird, like, synth wavy, dubstepy, it was really weird music playing. And then in the next video, she changed it, of course. She changed it to classical music. Yeah,
it's like, it's really, like, kind of contradictory and hypocritical, because it shows, like, how, like, self-unaware they are, because they're always, like, decrying, like, modern art and postmodern art, which they actually conflate modern art with, like, postmodernism all the time. They really can't even tell the difference. So it's, like, in their posts, but, like, that kind of... that whole aesthetic and that music, like, that's, like, you know, that's really, like, a kind of a form of postmodern art, or even, like, something newer than that. So it's, like, the fact that they're, like, constantly decrying this stuff, but it's, like, oh, but you don't realize that you actually do like this, you know? But that's it. It's not representational, you know, 15th century, this, like, representational work or anything. Like, it's totally, abstract, and it's photoshopped a lot of times. It's it's interesting to me, because it's kind of when what's his name, the other writer who writes my site, Decay, did this post that was called The Bearer of Trad News, where he talked about, like, these people, they aren't really trad,
and Decay writes for your site.
Yeah, he does. But it's kind of like, it's like, okay, you claim that you hate all of this, like, postmodernism and modern art and this degenerate stuff, but yet you're actually, like, embracing this aesthetic that isn't really, that isn't classical, that comes from, like, you know, 1980s, which is kind of like the, almost the height of
degeneracy.
And just kind of, like, the most, like, I don't want to say, but even like the most like kind of like Jewish influence to this culture, you know, with all of those movies and music and so
to
forth.
To bring things back to my book, I always have to like plug my book. Roger Blackstone is kind of like that because he has this ideology that's like, on one hand, he's a social nationalist, but he's also this psychedelic Hitler, and he has his own unique aesthetic. How would you describe Roger Blackstone's aesthetic on both Wilders of Vapor Island and the whole New York City scene? Does that appeal to you, Brandon?
Yeah, I think he's like kind of like a 1980s like really like a neon nationalist or something. like 1980s nationalism or something like that. That's where it's kind of that's what I get out of it. But I think that also he's kind of he's really like a 1980s Trump, but like with Trump, not how he is, but like everything that we would want to project onto him. It's like everything that you would project onto Trump, like hoping he would be, but that like he actually isn't. So I think that that's what it comes to mind when I think of your character, Roger Blackstone.
What do you think about all the Roman theme stuff, like in the palace and the erotic emporium, the whole Roman theme?
I like it. Those are some of my favorite parts of Vegas. I think that that's kind of. I've always like identified more with the Roman world. I think that was kind of when I was in fifth or sixth grade. That's when I started studying that kind of stuff, and that was when I was never really religious to begin with, but that's where I kind of decided, well, like, wow, like this stuff is so much better, you know, than like the Bible and all of that. Like, this is so much more interesting. Like, I prefer these aesthetics. And that was when I, even at a young age, I started to question, like, well, you know, just because this other side won or something, like, that doesn't mean that maybe we're not being told the whole story. Maybe this other civilization was better, you know, or something like that. The Roman world, like, maybe it was better before that. That's what I would, even at a young age, like sixth grade or something, I started thinking, like, gee, like, you know, it's kind of a shame that these guys lost.
Yeah, the Italian fascists kind of wanted to create like the Roman aesthetic and Roman empire,
They wanted to create a new Roman empire. They just didn't. They were completely delusional about their military ability to do so. Like, that was their their problem, and they made a big. A big mistake too, because they actually could have recreated that. It's just that they really had no business invading Greece and these other countries. It was just they would have done just fine if they would have just like rebuilt their society into that
I was watching that series Man in the High Castle about like a hypothetical German and Japanese takeover of America, and it actually has a pretty cool retro-futurist aesthetic, both in the German-controlled New York City. The German-controlled New York City is more kind of brutalist, but then there's also the Japanese-controlled San Francisco, and that it takes place in the 1960s, but it's fascistic, but it's very retro-futuristic.
Yeah, I watched a few episodes of that. I thought it was interesting too, especially the West Coast part of the story that was in, I think it was in California.
It was San Francisco.
But
what's interesting about comparing that, comparing the Man in the High Castle to the Bay Area today, in the Man in the High Castle, the Japanese are the elites living in this cool retro-futuristic city, but there's also a thriving white middle class, and they're sort of allowed to prosper as long as they don't speak out against the Japanese, but if they do speak out of the Japanese, they're tortured. And that's kind of the opposite of today's Bay Area, because today's Bay Area is basically the white middle class has been totally dispossessed. So even with sort of the really nasty aspects like torturing political dissidents, in some ways I actually prefer the San Francisco in the film to today's San Francisco. It's very retrofuturistic. Well,
I don't think that's surprising at all. I think that that's why I haven't watched the show, is because I feel like I would be annoyed at the kind of like moral posturing and whatnot, that it would, you'd have to watch through it and be like, oh, this is actually probably superior to what we live, but you still have to sit through this kind of like posturing where you're supposed to root for people to get out of it somehow or something like that. I think that's one of the reasons I've been resisting watching.
Ashley, you watched that? Did you notice, what did you think about the whole retro-futuristic theme in both New York and San Francisco?
Yeah, I thought about that as well. Probably not quite so much at the time, but I thought it was interesting. Yeah, especially in San Francisco. It's interesting that the whole thing with fascism, and I think the show kind of... maybe implicitly only, but it sort of went into this. With 20th century fascism, it's, you know, you were talking earlier about how it's hypocritical that these people like all of these modern aesthetics. I think it's perhaps more hypocritical of the Catholic traditionalist NRX types. With the neo-fascist types, it's possibly a little bit more debatable how hypocritical it is, because I think there are all sorts of interesting historical arguments about whether or not fascism was anti-modern, as opposed to being, say, a quest to create an alternative modernity. And I guess an alternative modernity is kind of what retrofuturism is all about.
Yeah, especially the Italian futurists, who were sort of a side movement that was supportive of Mussolini originally.
Yeah.
Well, I think also there's this tendency in the alt-right to basically lump all of fascism together, whereas like each different country had its own kind of style of fascism they weren't all the same. Like really, like the you notice that the British Union of Fascists was much more open to women. You know, they advertised for like equal pay for women and things like that, whereas the Italian fascism was much more like macho and much more like openly misogynist. Even the Italian futurist like manifesto was like it has a section in there about even included in the future, it said, and scorn for women, which seems like an odd thing to have in like a futurist manifesto, that you're going to throw it in your 10 points or whatever, like, and we're going to have scorn for all women or something like that. That's like kind of it's odd, but you see that the Italian fascism was completely different than British fascism, other than because each nation kind of had a different character to it.
Would you describe Brandon Roger Blackstone as a fascist?
I don't know, because the term is just so like the term is used to almost describe anything that's authoritarian now.
In the book, I call him, his critics call him the psychedelic Hitler.
Yeah, so. He's fascist in the sense of the contemporary meaning, which is just like anyone who's authoritarian, and maybe there's a collective element to it. But I don't think that, maybe not fascist in terms of like subscribing to like Mussolini's ideology completely or something like that. It's kind of been it depends how seriously you want to use the term. Kind of like when I wrote Beatnik Fascism, it was kind of abstract, or almost kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, like, that actually did inspire, Beatnik Fascism kind of partially inspired some of the things in my book, like the psychedelic Hitler. But one of the funny things about my book is Roger Blackstone has this eugenics program, and Carlos de la Boca he's the gay Puerto Rican character, and he's like, he turns to Noam, and this is at the Erotic Emporium, and he's like, I used to hate fascism and eugenics, but now I have like this unlimited supply of like these good looking blonde twinks, and like Blackstone was onto something.
Awesome. But yeah, I mean, I acknowledge, obviously, I mean, I've talked about this with Brandon, that the way people go on about Nazism, and I think that definitely people have trouble thinking about fascism in any kind of objective way is certainly true. But to be honest, it's certainly not, it's not really a term that I would identify myself with, fascism, at least not seriously.
I mean, I think that the term is kind of...
It would feel... I mean, it would feel like LARPing, I mean, if I called myself it seriously.
Right. It's only if I watch old interviews with people like Mosley and reading his books or whatnot, it was kind of advocating a really, like, a technocratic futurism, I think. And so it's like, in that sense, I'm like, yeah, I do identify with it. It's just the problem is that... the term itself, it has such connotations that it just brings these other things to mind. But if you're talking about, like, if you watch, like, old interviews with Mosley and stuff, particularly the ones he did in the 60s and 70s, after all of it, like, you can completely be like, wow, like, this guy should have been the leader of Britain, you know? And it's kind of like he's been made into this a monster or something, but yeah, I don't think that, like, in terms of just identifying as an example, I just don't think that that it's something that, like, I don't think it's something that's really going to take off. Or if it does take off, it's going to be fascism in the vein of something that, like, I really don't like. Something that, like, maybe the alt-right has projected onto it, which is just, like, you know, bringing back prohibition or something like that. And it's like, you know,
so
yeah,
I guess that's
not the kind of fascism for me, you know.
So, Ashley, you did write a couple of film reviews. One of them was of that recent gay film. I forget what it's called, but your article...
Call Me By Your Name.
Oh, Call Me By Your Name. It takes place in Italy about in the 80s, about two Jewish teenagers from America who go to... Italy to have, like, wonderful erotic experiences. And I know, like, conservatives, both the alt-right and mainstream conservatives, are really morally outraged about this film and saying it's promoting, like, pederasty. And
yeah, you could almost say that that's the very reason that I decided to watch it. Yeah, but I remember a certain person, I think it might have been Nick Fuentes, that most legendary of thinkers, was you know, saying, "Oh, this is a film about gay Jewish pedophiles," and so at that point I was just like,
"Oh
okay,
man, he would really have a field day with my book."
Yeah. So at that point, I knew for certain that I was going to watch it, review it. Yeah.
Any comments on those issues? Homosexuality.
Well, as far as homosexuality goes, I consider it neither good nor bad. I'm just kind of neutral towards it. It's just another sexual behavior, and it basically is what it is. And as far as the whole Jewish element within the film is concerned, which is another thing that people have commented on. I mean, I just find it interesting. I just find it interesting to look at these things, because the whole Jewish component to the film seemed almost, I don't want to say like an afterthought, but it felt almost like that, as if it was just there to fulfill some desire on the part of the director. Except the director isn't Jewish, I don't think, but the writer of the original source material is. And there are a lot of interesting themes in there about American culture and Jewish anxiety about their identity, specifically Ashkenazim, European Jewry, or I guess so-called European Jewry, if you want to say that.
Do you have any thoughts on the whole topic of, like, ephebophilia?
I have an incredibly controversial position on this, but
go for
I guess... Fuck it, yeah. To be honest, I would just reduce the age of consent probably to something like 13 and be done with it. And I have actual reasons for this. It's because, obviously, the two main things that people would worry about are the physical problems and also psychological problems. I think by the age of 13, almost everybody is probably physically mature, so then it's just an issue of the psychological issues possible from having sex at that kind of age. I'm not saying everybody at that age should do it at all. I'm just talking about, like, there's some maxim about, you know, don't multiply laws beyond necessity, and I think the way the laws are set up now are multiplied beyond necessity, because there's always going to be some ambiguity. The only way you can completely remove that ambiguity is either to just set it ridiculously high, the age of consent, that is, like 20, which I think most people would agree is ridiculous.
Well, it's 18 in the United States.
It's 16 here. Yeah, but even with something like 16, it can be very... I think this is the phrase I used with to Brandon when I was talking to him about this. It can be very stupidity-generating, is probably the best way to describe it. For instance, there's a relatively, well, within the UK, famous anyway, there was this randy 15-year-old teenage girl chasing after a footballer in Britain, and apparently she was, like, sexually pursuing him, you know, constantly over a period of months. And when he eventually caved in to her advances and let her fellate him, he got 6 years in prison, which, to be quite honest, just seems like a waste of taxpayers' money, especially considering that that guy probably had money coming out of his arse being a footballer. Yeah, it's just really stupid.
On that topic, you mentioned you did watch the film The Crush based on the show we did. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah. And it did an interesting job at portraying a culture in America, a sort of aristocratic culture, which I am... I do have a lot of affection for, even though I'm not a monarchist or anything like that. But, of course, America never had a monarchy.
Oh, are you talking about the scene where Alicia Silverstone's, like, playing the piano in the fluffy dress?
Yeah, that was interesting. And horse riding and all these kind of... Yeah, yeah.
Her character is very much kind of like an old wealth kind of waspy character.
Yeah, and it's like so weird and trippy to see these journalists sometimes in the US now talking about, you know, unironically using the term wasp as if it's still a thing now, when it just doesn't bear any connection to present reality. It's largely gone.
Is she like your ideal type?
I don't know. Like, looking back, in what particular regard do you mean? Like, sorry, can you like elaborate a bit?
Like, he wants to know if Alicia Silverstone is like your kind of girl.
Yeah, yeah, I do find her attractive. Like, historically, I think
her family is from England.
Yeah, I have more of a past with them. With brunettes, I think, but yeah,
I think she is a natural brunette. I think her hair is just dyed blonde.
No, she's natural blonde.
Yeah,
I don't know. I know that Sarah Michelle Gellar has dark hair.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly didn't find her unattractive, and yeah, there were definitely moments in that film that I found sexually arousing. But yeah,
since we're on this controversial topic, are you familiar with that British photographer David Hamilton who did those art nudes in Europe? And I know he committed suicide recently.
Very vaguely. I think I might have heard about it from maybe you talking about it or someone else who moves in these circles, but I'm not really familiar with him, no.
Yeah, we just kind of have to cover like all the taboo issues.
Yeah, especially the whole ephebophilia thing. You know, for these people who are always going on about modernity, the idea that anything below, you know, whatever the age of sexual consent happens to be in your country, you know, that's absolutely an artifact of modernity. I mean, I'm not an anti-modernist. I'm just saying it's, you know, even 40 years ago, this attitude wasn't nearly as prevalent.
But even in continental Europe, like France, Germany, Scandinavia,
yeah,
they're more laid back about that issue.
Yeah, and, you know, the age of consent in Italy and Germany as well, I think, is 14, so, yeah.
Yeah, I remember, like, a few years ago or something, like I was on, like, OkCupid or something, and, like, I was messaging with some girl, and then and she was in, like, Sweden or something like that, and I was talking to her, and she's like, "Are you aware I'm 15?" And I'm like, "No, like, what are you doing on this site?" You know, it's because I didn't realize that the age of consent there was actually lower, so they would be on, like, these dating sites and whatnot. And so, like, I stopped talking to her after that. But I was like, you know, but I didn't, like, even realize at the time that in all of these European countries, like, the age of consent is like 16, 15, 14, in some cases.
So there's this
idea in America that's like that anything any 18 is totally abnormal, but that you see in all of these other countries, it's just like it's the concept of it is completely different.
I guess we're getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add about this topic?
I think not that's really. About. No, I think that's about everything. Yeah, we covered most of the bases.
I think we've said enough to offend just about every group of people in that topic.
And Brandon, is there anything?
Although, actually, I would want to add something to that, and that is that I've often wondered if the age of consent should be higher, actually, for males, because women tend to mature faster than guys do. So the age of consent is the same for both. Men and women, I've often wondered, is like, should it be higher for males because they tend to be less physically and mentally developed as girls around that time.
Yeah, I think most,
should it be higher for males than females? I'm not saying like what age it should be. I'm just saying like, and that kind of even goes into.
Think it should be for heterosexual males, but for gay males, I'll make an exception. That's all I'll say. I'm just saying that.
Well, gay males should be even higher.
No, I think.
Or you just think?
I think it should be lower, but I'm just saying that to piss people off.
They can't get pregnant because they can't get pregnant.
I'm just trying to be a troll.
I know. Well, you're just trying to stir shit, but it's interesting though how like so many people. Who listen to this kind of stuff and read this kind of, like, they really, like, can't detect any kind of, like, irony or anything. Like, they have trouble. I just constantly see that time and time again. Like, they just have this kind of, I'm not a horseshoe theory guy, but even, like, there is something to the fact where, like, the right wing does have a similar kind of outrage culture, you know, when, like, some, like, post something, they freak out, and they jump all over it, even if the person is just totally, like, fucking around, like.
We're at the end of the show, but I just want to thank all the Ephebophile retro-futurist fascists for listening.
Yeah.
And anyhow, thanks Ashley Messenger and Brandon Adamson for being on.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Take care, guys.
Yes, I very much enjoyed it. We'll see you next time.
See you.